broken her shin when they first met a few weeks ago, but Duan Fen had been stupid enough to try fighting him. She was still stuck in a splint, thanks to him, limping around, slower than she'd ever been in her life. Einar promised they would find her a healer soon. A guard healer, not the shady Thai doctor he had initially hired to patch her up. For now, she had to grit her teeth through the pain and hobble. She kept her distance from the beast as much as possible. "Shall we?" Einar asked, and extended his arm to Duan Fen. "Yes," she replied. She slipped her hand through the crook of Einar's elbow and let him support some of her weight. They strolled inside, crunching across shattered glass and a broken door, following the path of destruction. The beast was a lunatic, and for all his smart talk, Duan Fen figured that Einar was as well. Still, she had to admit, she enjoyed what they were doing. Duan Fen had been under someone's heel her entire life. It felt good to be the one doing the stomping. "Tell me about this man," she said to Einar as they walked through a hallway lined with fine art. It was a collection that belonged in a museum, stuck in here to only be appreciated by one very rich asshole. "His name is Montgomery Eubanks," Einar said. "He used to run a hedge fund, but now he mostly works as a movie producer. He does the same job as your friend back in Thailand." "He wasn't my friend," Duan Fen said sharply, her hand tightening on Einar's arm. "E.C., figure of speech," Einar replied. "He manages a small network of buyers, auctions off the merchandise that the Foundation has on offer. Supposed to be anonymous, compartmentalized. The Foundation is structured so that no one knows everyone's identity. Small interlocking circles. They think it keeps them safe. But I know some names, and every one of them I find... well, they aren't so hard to make talk, are they?" "You've told me all this before," Duan Fen replied. She brushed her fingers across a marble statue of a centaur shooting a bow and arrow. "Will this Montgomery know where we can find a healer?" "I hope so," Einar replied. "We'll gain access to his tablet and see where the Foundation healers are assigned. Then we'll go liberate one, just like I liberated you." "And if he doesn't have this information?" "Well, to start with, we'll kill him and steal his money."
"We plan to do that anyway."
Einar smiled.
"True."
From deeper in the mansion came a rending sound like steel being ripped in half, followed by a terrified shriek. The beast must have found where Montgomery went to hide. Einar picked up his pace a bit, and Duan Fen had to grit her teeth to keep up. They rounded a corner just as a pair of guards came charging down an adjacent stairwell. So, the beast hadn't killed everyone in here. The two guards were well-trained and fast. They raised their handguns and fired. Duan Fen was faster. With one telekinetic burst, she knocked their arms in the air so their bullets thudded harmlessly into the ceiling. Then, Einar took over.
"You hate each other," he said coldly. "You've hated each other for years. Why don't you finally do something about it?"
Duan Fen could see the rage bubble up in the guards' faces. Neck veins popped, eyes widened, teeth bared. Like mirror images, they turned and shot each other in the chest. Einar barely glanced at the guards as they fell to the floor. He pulled on Duan Fen's arm, and they continued past the staircase.
"Come on," he said. "We don't want to leave Montgomery alone with our friend."
They followed the sounds of frightened whimpering and emerged into a cozy room that served as a library. Most of the books were on the floor now.
one of the large shelves having been thrust aside so someone, Montgomery obviously, could gain access to a panic room. 2 feet of solid steel, sealed by a heavy-duty magnetic lock. That had been the panic room door, at least until the beast got hold of it. He'd cleaved it in half like a tuna can. Duan Fen swallowed, a wave of relief passing through her. She'd been lucky back in Thailand that all that monster did was break her leg. The beast sat hunched in a high-backed chair, breathing heavily. Their quarry, Montgomery Eubanks, was laid out at his feet, one of the beast's boots on his neck, so the man could just barely suck in air. Montgomery was handsome and polished, in that way Duan Fen had noticed a lot of rich men were. A result owed to subtle plastic surgeries and moisturizer. His tuxedo was all shredded, and his head was bleeding, but he was alive. Alive and totally still, not moving a muscle, probably afraid that the beast would crush his throat if he so much as flinched.
"Happy New Year, Monty!" Einar shouted.
He gestured to the beast.
"It's okay. You can let him up."
The beast slid his foot away, and Montgomery sat up, coughing and rubbing his throat.
"You demented little brat!" Montgomery said, glaring at Einar. "You know you'll never get away with this, don't you?"
Einar smirked at Duan Fen.
"They always say that."
"They're looking for you," Montgomery said. "Powerful people! You can't hide from them forever."
Einar stretched out his arms.
"Who's hiding? Not me. Where are these powerful people?"
He put his hand over his eyes as if to shield them from the sun, then pointed at the dead body of one of Montgomery's guards.
"Is that one over there?"
"You're..."
With a snap of Einar's fingers, Montgomery fell silent. His eyes took on a glazed quality, and his mouth, seconds ago twisted in anger, fell half open so that Duan Fen thought he might start drooling. Despite the cut on his forehead and his dire situation, the businessman suddenly had a look of stoned calm. That was Einar's doing.
"Enough small talk, I think," Einar said. "Montgomery, would you be so kind as to fetch your tablet for me? We're in need of a healer."
Montgomery got to his feet and stumbled into the panic room, picking his way delicately through the curled shreds of metal that used to be the door. He returned with his tablet, an exact replica of the one Duan Fen's executive had carried, and handed it over to Einar.
There are no healers," Montgomery said, his voice slurring. "None available."
Einar raised an eyebrow as he flicked through the information on Montgomery's tablet. It was all there. Guard potentially up for auctions, contact information, bank accounts. Another small window into the foundation that they could force their way through.
"Where are the healers?" Einar asked.
"Don't know,"
Montgomery answered, swaying on his feet like a hypnotism victim at a magic show.
"Special assignment. Outside my knowledge. Heard rumors about Siberia."
"Siberia?"
Einar cocked his head.
"What's in Siberia?"
Montgomery shrugged his shoulders in a way Duan Fen found utterly childish. She sighed and shifted on her feet, the bones in her leg grinding like uneven gears. She would have to live with this pain a little longer yet.
"There is one,"
Montgomery mumbled, leaning in to open a file on his tablet.
"There is one potential. Sources say recruitment should be soon."
Einar looked down at the open file and let loose a laugh. Duanfen had never heard a noise like that come out of him. Einar never sounded surprised about anything.
Her? Einar asked, his eyes shining. The Foundation thinks they can recruit her? Again? Because it went so well the first time.
Montgomery nodded dumbly.
Reports are she's disgruntled. Susceptible.
Duanfen craned her neck to look at the screen. There was a blonde girl pictured there. Pretty, if chubby-cheeked in that way Duanfen immediately associated with all Americans.
You know her, she said to Einar.
We've met, Einar replied.
He rubbed the back of his head, fingering a knot of scar tissue.
She hit me with a shovel. She doesn't like you. In her defense, I was trying to kill her friends.
Duanfen's eyes narrowed.
You said we don't kill our own kind. Not when we can avoid it, obviously. It was a complicated time. I was a bit out of my mind.
Duanfen tilted her head. Did this strange boy think he was in his right mind now? She wondered, not for the first time, what she had gotten herself into. Over Montgomery's shoulder, she could see the beast sitting stone still in his high-backed chair, somehow managing to loom over them without even standing up. Perhaps detecting her unease, Einar put a hand on her shoulder. Duanfen knew that he could use his legacy to make her trust him. She wouldn't even know it was happening. Einar could easily make her a loyal soldier, as empty-headed as Montgomery. But he hadn't. The skepticism she continued to nurture was evidence enough that he'd kept his word from their first meeting and not used his legacy on her. Instead, he talked. Always talked.
I've changed, Einar said gently. I used to believe the Foundation cared about me. It took Taylor here.
He looked down at the girl on the tablet.
It took her causing some trouble to open my eyes. When I made a mistake, I saw how expendable I was to the Foundation. At first, I was furious with her and her friends. I thought they ruined my life. I wanted to hurt them. But now I realize that anger was misplaced. I should have thanked Taylor and the others. She cut the gilded leash the Foundation had around my neck, made me realize that we guard can only rely on each other, and that we can't let anyone control us. Isn't that right, Monty?
The rich man murmured agreement. Duanfen said nothing. Einar liked to talk about this new world he was creating, but so far it was only the three of them. Not exactly a revolution. Not yet. Even so, for the first time in her life, Duanfen felt truly free. She liked it. If the Foundation spies are right, and Taylor really is sick of the Academy. Einar's thin lips compressed into a smile. He minimized the girl's picture. Then he opened up a banking app and typed in an account number, passing the tablet back to Montgomery.
Be a good boy and transfer your liquid assets, eh, Montgomery? Be quick about it. Seems we've got to do some recruiting of our own.
Chapter 13 The Fugitive Six The Human Guard Academy, Point Reyes, California. Copano sat on the couch in Taylor's dorm suite, with his head in his hands. She sat next to him, watching him closely, and occasionally reaching out to pat his back.
I feel like I just want to hide, Copano said.
Isabella answered with a wave of her hand. She sat on a chair opposite, air-drying her freshly painted fingernails.
Why should you hide? They should be giving you a medal and a movie deal for crushing those puñeteros.
I didn't want to crush anyone, Copano replied.
He peeked out from between his fingers and looked over at Ran. She stood next to the window, quiet, watching as most of the student body gathered in the courtyard below. A makeshift stage had been set up there for the talent show, part of the festivities the administration had cooked up for New Year's Eve.
We know you didn't, Taylor told him gently. They had it coming, Isabella insisted. I say it's too bad you didn't crush more of them.
Copano looked up at her.
You didn't see the video?
Nope. I didn't see it happen in person either, because they had already shot me. You remember? If not for you and the others, I would probably be dead in a ditch or on a hook in a meat locker like that girl the harvesters kidnapped. I feel nothing for them. You shouldn't either, you softy.
What did Professor Nine and Malcolm say about it? Taylor asked.
They were mad, obviously, Ran replied.
She looked at Copano.
They will protect us. They promised.
Where are your two boyfriends? Isabella asked him with a smirk. They should be here.
Copano shrugged and started to say he didn't know, but Ran interrupted with a chin jerk in the direction of the courtyard.
They're getting ready to perform, she said. I see them down there.
Isabella snorted.
I thought Nigel said such a non-paying gig would be beneath him.
Copano stood up abruptly, wiped the back of his hand across his eyes, and put on a resolute face.
We must go, he said.
Taylor looked up at him.
Weren't you just talking about hiding out for the rest of your life?
I'm over it, Copano said.
Isabella shook her head, and Taylor gave him a look. They both knew that wasn't true. For all his braggadocio, Copano was probably the most sensitive one of them all. Or at least the most idealistic. That video of him hurting the harvesters would gnaw at him. Copano caught their looks and shrugged.
Fine. I'm not over it. But there's nothing I can do about it now.
He waved his hand dramatically.
And what kind of friend would I be if I missed the debut performance of Nigel and the Clones, huh?
A friend with eardrums, Isabella replied.
The four of them arrived on the lawn while Lisbeth was still on stage. She used her legacies to create towering ice sculptures of fairies and nymphs while doing interpretive dance to some tinkling New Age track. Most of the student body, along with many administrators, were already there, watching from picnic blankets and politely clapping whenever Lisbeth pulled off a flourish.
I hate this ballet crap, Isabella said a little too loudly.
Some instructors turned around to give her a look. She ignored them.
There's no beat, no passion.
You have to admit the sculptures are pretty, Ran replied, gazing up at the delicate glass-like wings that Lisbeth crafted with deft motions of her fingertips.
I admit nothing, Isabella said.
Taylor rubbed her arms.
She's making it cold out here.
Copano interpreted that as a signal and happily put his arm around Taylor's shoulder. Isabella smiled at that and tried to catch Taylor's eye, but Taylor deliberately avoided her look. She'd been very cagey about whether Copano and she were a thing now ever since their kiss. Isabella could tell that Copano at least thought they were. Giving up on exchanging glances with Taylor, Isabella craned her neck to look around.
I wonder if anyone smuggled in some booze.
Doubt it, Taylor said. I knew this would be too wholesome for me.
The New Year's Eve festivities were a campus-wide thing. There was the talent show stage out there in the courtyard, where they would later play some outdoor movies once the student entertainment ran out. There were board game stations set up in the student union, where all-night breakfast was being served.
Supposedly, Professor Nine had traveled to Mexico to personally procure a buttload of primo fireworks. The students and faculty were all there, plus even some UN peacekeepers who hadn't drawn guard duty. It reminded Taylor of the yearly lock-in her old school had done to raise money for whatever charity the seniors selected. Everyone seemed to be having a good time. Not as good of a time as Isabella would have wanted, but still. A few people shot uneasy looks at Copano and Ran. Those came more from the administrators and soldiers than the other guard, actually. But the Wolf News video failed to cast a major pall over events. Even Taylor let some of her carefully cultivated bad girl persona slip for the night. She leaned into Copano.
"I think everything's going to be fine," she told him.
"Really?" he replied.
"Just a feeling I've got," Taylor smiled. "First time I've had that feeling in a while, actually."
After Lisbeth finished up with her ice sculptures, a team of duplicates hustled by her. They set to work plugging in guitars and assembling a drum kit. Copano rubbed his hands together.
"Yes! Here we go!"
Nigel slapped Caleb on the shoulder.
"You ready, mate?"
Through the eyes of his duplicates already on stage, Caleb could see the crowd. Altogether, there probably weren't more than 100 people out there. But they were the 100 people who he'd spent nearly every day around for the last year. Normally, it would be pretty embarrassing to flame out in front of them.
"If we bomb, I might not have to see most of these people again," Caleb replied, thinking about his looming departure from the academy.
"That's the spirit," Nigel said.
He grabbed a bottle of water and dumped the entire thing over his face and head, soaking through his white tank top.
"Let's go!"
Nigel jogged out onto the stage and Caleb followed. Caleb, like all his duplicates, wore a black button-down shirt, dark slacks, and a red bow tie. Nigel, of course, had chosen the outfits. A round of applause that Caleb thought sounded skeptical greeted their arrival. Nigel swaggered right up to the mic stand where the lead guitar was propped and slung it on. Meanwhile, Caleb positioned himself behind the keyboard. There weren't a lot of keys in the songs they'd chosen, but this spot afforded Caleb the best view of the stage and his duplicates. It helped him multitask the parts if he could oversee his clones, rather than have to look through each one's eyes. There was a clone on bass and one on drums, plus one carrying a megaphone and dancing around, a role Nigel referred to as Hype Man. Caleb focused. Simultaneously, all the duplicates readied their instruments.
"We are Nigel and the clones," Nigel growled.
He looked down at the mic, then kicked the stand over and used his legacy to amplify his voice.
"And we're here to make you shit your britches."
That was Caleb's cue.
"One, two," he said into his mic. "One, two, three, four! I get nervous!"
Nigel shrieked. And they were off, beginning with a loud and jangly rendition of I Get Nervous by The Lost Sounds, followed by Vertigo by The Screamers, and closing with the Sweet's Blockbuster. Nigel played his lead guitar like he was trying to choke it. He writhed across the edge of the stage, kicked wildly at the air, and punctuated every shouted lyric with an appropriately dramatic snarl. At one point during the set, Caleb was pretty sure Nigel lay down on his back and did some hip thrusts. Caleb couldn't pay too much attention to Nigel during the performance. He was too busy making sure the duplicates stayed in time with each other, that the messy punk songs didn't get too incomprehensible. He felt like a conductor almost, flitting between his duplicates, putting the bass guitarist on autopilot so he could slow down the drummer, who had gone out of control. His own fingers stabbed at the keyboard almost without thought. He was in total control, yet it also felt to Caleb like an enormous act of letting go. He wondered briefly
what his dad and brothers would think if they saw him up here. Caleb wasn't the only one up there using his legacy. Nigel pitched in too, although Caleb could never be sure how much his friend's sonic manipulation played into their band's sound. If one of the clones went off-key, Nigel bent their sound until Caleb could fix it. If one of them played too fast or too slow, Nigel lowered the volume on them until they got back in time. Even though Nigel thought it would be more theatrical if the duplicates performed with stony stoicism, Caleb couldn't help but let his grin spread onto all of their faces. It was a team effort, a masterpiece. It was the most in sync Caleb had felt in his entire life. They rocked it. When it was over, the crowd clapped politely. A lot of the instructors stuck fingers in their ears to make sure they could still hear, then blew out sighs of relief. The students made faces at each other, laughed, and mimed headbanging. Isabella took her hands away from her ears.
"Is it over?"
Taylor nodded.
"They're done." "Thank God," she said. "You have to admire their enthusiasm,"
Rand said diplomatically. Taylor snickered, then glanced over at Copano. He stood a few yards in front of the girls, both hands over his head in the shape of devil horns, bellowing for an encore.
"Well," she said, "at least they've got one groupie."
With the talent show over, most of the student body broke off into smaller groups, the same cliques that always tended to form up in the dining hall. Tweebs, Elemental Legacies, fans of the Smiths, the Academy's fledgling drama club, etc. They mingled, played board games, stuffed their faces, or watched TV in the student union. They had the New Year's Eve countdown on. It was the first time that the ball would be dropping in the rebuilt Times Square. New York City still looked bombed out and emptier than it used to. Big gaps in the skyline, like the city had gotten punched in the mouth. But there were crowds and bands and noisemakers and the countdown, the process repeating twice until it was finally the West Coast's turn. The Fugitive Six didn't hang out to watch. None of them would have been able to explain exactly why, but it felt weird for them to mingle with the rest of the student body. There was a strange sense after Nigel and the clones' performance that this was a special night, a momentous night. The six of them all snuck down to the beach. They didn't even talk about doing it. They just went. At some point, Isabella had slipped away and returned with two bottles of champagne and some beers filched from one of the faculty apartments. The popped cork on the first bottle sounded like a gunshot on the empty beach, and for a second they all stared at each other, ducked low and stayed still like they were trying to hide. But no one came looking for them. They passed the bottle around. They tossed smooth rocks into the cold waves, dancing away from the foamy tide. They ran up and down the beach, playing some game of tag that no one was really sure of the rules for. Distantly, they could hear chanting from the student union. The countdown. They joined in, screaming numbers into the night. Professor Nine timed his fireworks display to erupt with the new year. It was as badass as he'd promised. Chaotic blooms of red and gold, fizzy bolts of silver, yellow bursts that expanded into the shape of smiley faces. The sand under their toes became like a kaleidoscope. Nigel tossed his arm around Ran's shoulder and kissed her wetly on the cheek. She scrunched up her face and laughed. Taylor and Copano kissed. A peck on the lips that lingered. Caleb's mouth fell open when he saw that. Nigel didn't have the heart to tell him about Copano's success over Christmas. Although Caleb's stomach did a loop, the warm feeling from the champagne softened the blow. Maybe Isabella saw Caleb staring at Taylor and Copano,
and that's why she flung her arms around his neck and planted a wet kiss on him, all tongue and heat. When it was over, Caleb stammered, and Isabella held a finger in his face.
"Don't get any ideas, weirdo. It's just New Year's."
She kissed all the others, too, after that, but none the way she'd kissed Caleb. At some point, Nigel climbed up onto a sand dune and got everyone's attention. He held his beer bottle like a microphone.
"Well, since the lad is too shy to tell you lot himself, it's on me to announce that tonight's performance of Nigel and the Clones will likely be our last for a while."
Nigel held the bottle out like he was making a toast.
"Our friend Caleb here is off to Earthguard, ready to protect the world with his legion of basic white bread meatheads. We're going to miss you, mate."
Everyone was surprised, taken aback as a group, because partying down on the beach had started to feel like it was a place they would never leave. Kopano hugged Caleb, patting him hard enough on the back to knock the wind out of him. Ran went over to him and held both of his hands, bowing to him in a very traditional Japanese way, made a little wobbly because Ran didn't have much of a head for champagne. Caleb watched Isabella dance through the waves with her dress hiked up to mid-thigh. She was smirking at him, and he wondered if she knew he was thinking about kissing her again. These moments stretched out, the night a blur. At one point, Taylor stood next to Caleb. Everyone else was down the beach. It was quiet.
"I'm sorry you're going," Taylor said, realizing it was true only as she spoke the words. "I wish we'd gotten to know each other better."
"Yeah," Caleb replied. "Sorry I was so weird at first."
"Don't be sorry." Taylor looked around. "I think we're all a little weird."
They didn't talk about the Foundation, or Einar, or any of the crap they'd been through. They just celebrated. Only Taylor had ever actually been to summer camp, but that's what it felt like. The end of summer camp. Until Dr. Linda appeared. Ran was the first to see the diminutive psychiatrist as she waddled up the beach with a flashlight held out in front of her. At first, Ran thought that maybe she was seeing things, so she pulled on Nigel's sleeve and pointed at Dr. Linda.
"Is she real?" Ran asked.
"What the shit?" Nigel replied quietly. Dr. Linda paused when she saw their little group and let out a sigh of relief. She plucked a walkie-talkie off her belt and spoke into it.
"I found him down on the beach," Linda said. "It's okay."
The moment was surreal. The guards stood in a loose semicircle, facing Dr. Linda. Their good mood dashed, uncertain what would happen next. Some of them, like Nigel and Taylor, had spent too much time staring at Linda's picture on the bulletin board in their secret lair under the training center. They were paranoid. Was this the night the Foundation made their move? What else could she be doing here? Others, like Isabella, had more grounded concerns. Were they going to get in trouble again? Technically, the beach wasn't off limits. Caleb discreetly kicked a spent champagne bottle behind a piece of driftwood. Finally, Dr. Linda spoke. She didn't seem mad or villainous. She seemed oddly somber.
"Nigel," she said, "we've been looking for you."
"Me?"
Nigel replied, squinting at her.
"Looking for me?"
"Yes. You need to come with me."
The guard all tensed up, tightening their ranks around Nigel. Dr. Linda stared at them like she couldn't comprehend.
"The hell would I go anywhere with you, Linda?" Nigel replied.
But before Dr. Linda could reply, More flashlights appeared on the beach. There were a couple of peacekeepers, Malcolm Good and Professor Nine, in the lead. He bounded ahead of the others, almost as if he'd anticipated this particular crew of guard might have an adverse reaction to being confronted by Dr. Linda.
"Nigel," Nine said breathlessly. "Damn, dude. We've been looking for you."
Now, seeing Nine acting weird was the first time Nigel actually felt worried. Rand put a hand on his shoulder.
"That's what she said," Nigel replied, waving a hand at Dr. Linda.
He put on a cavalier smile.
"What's the hubbub, then? People clamoring for an encore?"
"Nigel," Nine frowned. He looked over his shoulder at the other administrators as if for help. When Dr. Linda opened her mouth to say something, Nine cut her off and plowed ahead.
"There's no easy way to say this, buddy."
"Spit it out, Nine."
"Nigel, your dad died."
Chapter 14. Nigel Barnaby, London, England. Nigel put his hand on the wrought iron gate of the St. John's Wood house, but couldn't bring himself to push it open. Instead, he stood on the sidewalk in the damp English weather and pulled the collar of his coat tighter against a sudden chill. This was the house where he grew up. Two stories of white brick, with twice that many chimneys for the home's multiple fireplaces. It looked like a country manor plunked down in northern London, but then most of the houses around here looked that way. The buildings were tightly packed together. This was still the city, after all. But what one couldn't see from the sidewalk was the sprawling backyard that looked like a polo ground, lined with immaculate rows of oak trees to provide total privacy from the neighbors. From the sidewalk, people couldn't see the basement addition, the pool and billiards table, the home theater. From the sidewalk, they couldn't see the years of misery Nigel had spent there, thinking that things couldn't get worse. Until they did. Nigel was in no rush to get inside. He shifted his backpack around on his tired shoulders. His eyes were dry and heavy. His limbs felt fuzzy. He hadn't slept in, well, with the time difference, Nigel supposed that he technically hadn't slept since the day before yesterday. He felt a little bit like he was dreaming. The block was quiet now. In the early morning, it usually was. Clean and tree-lined, with no pedestrians. There was a black limousine parked at the curb. He supposed that would be their transportation to the funeral. Behind that was parked an unassuming brown van, which, at that very moment, rolled down its windows so the driver could call to Nigel.
"Everything okay?"
The driver's name was Ken Colton, an American, a UN peacekeeper. He was in charge of the four-man detail assigned to accompany Nigel on his visit home. He had square features, salt-and-pepper hair, and reminded Nigel of a TV dad from some sitcom. Or maybe Nigel was just feeling sentimental. Nigel's hesitation to go inside had raised an alarm with the peacekeepers, but Nigel waved them off.
"It's fine," he said. "Just bracing myself, you know?"
Colton nodded like he understood, gave Nigel that tight-lipped, sympathetic smile that he'd been seeing a lot of lately, and rolled the window back up. With a sigh, Nigel pushed open the creaky gate and trudged towards his home.
"I vowed never to go back there," he had told Ran. "Those people are toxic, all of them. I'd like to forget they ever existed."
"I know," she replied softly.
"So you agree then," Nigel concluded. "I shouldn't go. Tell Mum to piss off and be done with it, once and for all."
"I didn't say that."
This was early morning on New Year's Day. The two of them sat on a bench outside the student union. The campus quiet. Everybody sleeping in, or otherwise cozied up in the dorms. Nigel's mouth still felt sticky and tasted bitter, even after he'd brushed his teeth 3 times. He had thrown up that morning. Nigel told himself it was from the drinking, but he hadn't had that much. He tried to ignore the growing knot in his belly. That old anxiety. Like he used to feel at his boarding school. Like he used to feel at home. It hadn't started right away. When Dr. Linda and Nine interrupted their beach party to break the news, Nigel had basically felt numb. The whole night seemed surreal, like it was happening to someone else. For months, Nigel had barely thought about his dad, and he assumed the reverse was true as well. Hearing about his death was like learning that the dictator of some distant despotic nation had died. All Nigel could think was, "Oh, good." The mounting sense of dread hadn't really kicked in until Dr. Linda and Nine ushered him to a private room where his mom waited on the phone. Nigel had never known B. Barnaby to tolerate being placed on hold, so she truly must have wanted to talk to him. The conversation seemed like part of a dream now, a hazy memory. Nigel could remember only snatches of what his mom said. Her voice sounded brittle on the phone, tinny and far away.
"You must come home, love," she told him. "You absolutely must. I know it hasn't seemed like it of late, but we are a family. We need each other more than you know."
Nigel recounted those details to Ran later that morning. He was already packed. The academy had lined up a helicopter to fly him off campus, and then a private plane to whisk him off to London. They had a security detail arranged for him. Now that it was all sorted, now that he had time to think about it, Nigel didn't want to go.
"She didn't even sound sad on the phone. Not really," Nigel told Ran. "More like desperate. Like I was the last caterer available on short notice. The funeral is sure to be a scene. All their colleagues and business partners and quote-unquote friends wouldn't look proper if I wasn't there."
Nigel paused. Ran waited, not pressing him.
"Dad's actually told me once that they only had kids to keep up appearances," Nigel continued eventually. "Like they needed parenting for a cocktail party conversation topic. In vast circles, leaders of industry and all that, he said it looked strange not to have a family. Wouldn't want people thinking we're queers, eh? He said that to me. I think I was 12.
Ran put her hand on Nigel's forearm.
"I'm sorry," she said.
"Thing that eats me up the most is that you didn't live long enough for me to tell him what a shit dad and a wanker he was," Nigel replied. "Now I'm supposed to go over there and pretend he meant something to me."
"You don't have to pretend."
Nigel looked up at her, that familiar cockeyed grin taking shape.
"You saying I should put all this in my eulogy?"
"No. I'm definitely not saying you should make a scene," Ran replied. "But you should look at this as a chance to find some closure. To pay your respects, or lack thereof. Let them see that you have become a great person in spite of them. Maybe there is a chance you can reconnect with your mom. If not, then you could put them behind you once and for all. But you will never know for sure if you don't go."
Nigel leaned his shoulder against Ran.
"Been storing that up somewhere? Jesus, most I've ever heard you speak all at once. You must be exhausted."
"Shut up," she replied.
When Nigel first set foot in the grand foyer of the Barnaby Manor, no one noticed what a great person he had become. In fact, no one noticed him at all. A swirling bustle of servants moved between the sitting room, the dining room, and the kitchen. They were in the midst of preparing for that afternoon's funeral. Setting out covered trays of food, arranging place settings, some last-minute dusting and polishing. Nigel recognized some of the servants. His parents employed a small retinue of butlers, maids, and groundkeepers, and quickly determined that they were in charge of supervising the temporary help, the caterers, waiters, and valets. None of them noticed Nigel standing there, dumb and mute. A framed photograph of Nigel's father sat on an easel just inside the front door, surrounded on all sides by masses of wreaths and bouquets, the flowers growing with each passing second as a florist and her team added new arrangements. Nigel stared at the not-so-recent picture of his father. He looked dapper and serious. Nigel had to think where he'd seen that image before. It was from his dad's company website, the photo he used to advertise financial services. Nigel stepped carefully around the throngs of people, feeling like they were all engaged in a complicated dance that he dared not interrupt. At least until he spotted Willoughby, the family's longest-tenured servant. The man stood imperiously supervising a team of maids as they dusted the brasswork on the main staircase. Nigel touched his sleeve. Willoughby turned with a raised eyebrow.
"Yes?"
"Have you seen my mum, Willoughby?"
"And you are?"
"It's me, Nigel, heir to all this aristocratic uselessness."
The older man squinted at Nigel for a long beat, as if he couldn't make sense of what he was seeing. However, as soon as things clicked, Willoughby bowed deeply at the waist and became appropriately obsequious.
"Master Barnaby, my sincerest apologies. You have changed."
Willoughby took Nigel's hand in his gloved one, clasping firmly.
"Might I add, heartfelt condolences on the passing of your father. He was a titan."
"He was a tit," replied Nigel briskly. "My mother, Willoughby, where is she?"
"Lady Barnaby has already departed for the cemetery, I'm afraid. Busy with some last-minute arrangements, I'm sure. Your sister is here, though. I believe she and her husband are downstairs."
After thanking Willoughby, Nigel skirted around the activity and took the elevator down to the basement. Immediately, the tang of salt water hit his nostrils, reminding him in a vague way of California. But, no matter how hard he wished it, Nigel wasn't back at the academy. That was simply the smell of the below-ground pool. The whole basement was cast in the water's shifting light, flashing aquamarine and gold. Jessa, Nigel's sister, didn't look back at him when the elevator opened. She sat with her feet soaking, already attired for the day's festivities in an appropriately formal black dress. Her blonde hair was tied back in a simple ponytail. Jessa was 8 years older than Nigel. Like him, Jessa had been sent off to boarding school when she turned 12, so they barely shared any time in this house together. To Nigel, she often felt more like a friendly cousin than a sister. "Hello, Jessa," Nigel called. Her head snapped around immediately.
"Nigel!"
she practically shrieked. She hopped up and ran to him, wet feet slapping against the marble tile. Jessa hugged him, and Nigel felt suddenly at home in a way that he wouldn't have thought possible.
"You're going to wrinkle your dress," he said, peeling free of his sister.
"Sorry, sorry," she replied. I wasn't sure you'd come."
"It's Dad's funeral," Nigel said. "Thought I should put in an appearance."
Jessa rolled her eyes.
"As if the old man did anything for you. For either of us. went and died on one of his business trips. Mom tell you that?
She didn't tell me much.
Heart attack in some third world country while he was doing God knows what. Call girls and cocaine, probably.
Nigel stared at his sister. It had been more than a year since he'd seen her, and even then their last visit hadn't been for any substantial length of time. Just the usual cold Christmas at Barnaby Manor. For the first time, he realized that Jessa had 8 more years of experience dealing with their parents than he did. No wonder she had married young and moved away from London.
"Hell, Jessa," Nigel replied with a shocked laugh. "I didn't realize I'd missed you."
Jessa pinched his cheek.
"Good to see you, too. Like I said, I wasn't sure. If I didn't show, Mother would disinherit me. I'd never hear the end of it. But you had a ready-made excuse. Important business, can't get away, I'm a bloody alien now."
Nigel blew out a sigh.
"Not an alien.
You know what I mean."
She took a step back from him.
"Go on, then. Don't keep me in suspense. Let me see something."
It took Nigel a moment to realize what Jessa wanted. Then he casually reached out with his telekinesis and levitated a nearby vase filled with multicolored sand. Jessa clapped, then waved her hands above and below the vase, as if to check for strings.
"Marvelous! Simply marvelous," she said. "Owen, did you see this?"
Nigel turned to see Owen, his brother-in-law, emerging from the nearby lounge, where a muted soccer match played on the widescreen television. Nigel had only met Owen a handful of times, and he'd never failed to remind Nigel of a grown version of a Pepperpont boy. Nigel tried not to hold that against him. Owen was generically handsome, clean-shaven, chestnut hair immaculately combed, his black suit slim and perfectly tailored to his rugby player's frame. He was, in Nigel's experience, perpetually attached to his phone, always checking stock prices. Even now, he had to slip the device into his jacket pocket before he could give Nigel a firm handshake.
"Nice to see you again, Nigel," Owen said.
He eyed the still floating vase.
"It's just like on the telly."
"Isn't it?"
Jessa agreed. She put her hands on her hips.
"So, lads, what should we do now?"
Nigel smiled. He could tell his sister was joking. But Owen looked flummoxed.
"We've got to get going, love," he said. "You know, the funeral."
"Oh, right," Jessa tapped her forehead. "That."
Owen glanced from Nigel to Jessa.
"He's supposed to change, isn't he?"
"Change?" Nigel asked.
"I think you look cool, brother," Jessa said, flicking one of the frayed strings on his hooded sweatshirt. "Like some conquering rock star returning home after a year-long bender, but with superpowers."
"That's what I was going for."
"But Mother Dearest gave me strict instructions to outfit you in the suit she left in your room. Better change, or else she'll have them dig an extra grave, eh?"
Nigel didn't see his mother until the cemetery. She stood out, even at a distance, as Nigel made his way along the path between mausoleums, flanked by Jessa and Owen. She sat in the front row, right beside the empty pit where they'd be lowering his father's gold-detailed coffin. It was drizzling, so maybe Nigel's mom had just grabbed the closest garment at hand. But Nigel sort of figured the bright white raincoat his mom wore over her black mourning dress to be some kind of statement.
"My son, don't you look nice?"
B. Barnaby said as Nigel took a seat beside her. The uncomfortable wooden chair was dry, thanks to the row of umbrella-wielding well-wishers situated behind the family.
"Thanks," Nigel replied, even as he pulled uncomfortably at his shirt collar.
He wore the simple black suit, white dress shirt and tie that his mom had left out for him. His discomfort at being dressed this way wasn't at all due to the clothes themselves. They fit perfectly, his mom somehow knowing his exact measurements. No self-respecting punk would wear this monkey suit. In a very small act of rebellion, Nigel had left his shirt's top button undone and tied a knot sloppy enough to earn demerits back at Pepperpot. Surprisingly, his mother didn't seem to care. She slipped a hand through the crook of his elbow and leaned against him. That was a pretty huge display of affection for the Barnaby family. Bea looked good for a woman in her early 50s. She wore her blonde hair in a jaw-length pageboy with a sharp side part. Her eyes were vivid blue and prone to dissecting looks. Bee's face was smooth, only a tasteful wrinkle here and there. Nigel was sure she'd had work done, but it was good work.
"You look tired," she said to him.
"Whirlwind 24 hours," Nigel said dryly.
"Lost Dad and all."
Bea cleared her throat, as if getting ready for a prepared remark.
"I know it might not have seemed like it, Nigel, but your father loved you very much."
Nigel snorted. He felt his mother's steely gaze upon him, but didn't dare meet her eyes. Ran was right. There was no point in making a scene, of making this any more miserable than it already had to be. Just get through it. Let his mother have her delusions. He was surprised when she leaned close to him, her lips to his ear.
"Fuck it, then," Bea whispered. "The man was a bastard, and we're better off rid of him. That's the bloody truth of it."
Nigel nearly burst out laughing. The crass admission from his mom was just so out of character. First Jessa, now her. Nigel had to admit to himself that maybe he'd built up just how terrible his family was. Maybe closure, or a new understanding of one another, like that two-faced Dr. Linda liked to say, was actually possible. He warmed to the feeling of his mom's hand on his arm.
"I want to hear everything," Bea said, "about your new life. Once all these dreadful formalities are over, we need to catch up."
"Yeah," Nigel replied. "That will be good, Mum."
Eventually, a priest showed up and said some words, read a few Bible verses. Nigel zoned out. He found himself doing that throughout the rest of the day. He was overtired, it was hard to focus, and a big part of his identity had been called into question. He'd always imagined himself as the great rebel, running off on his family, leaving all the bastards behind. But now, they didn't seem so cruel and distant. Instead, their lives seemed complicated and sad. The funeral director handed out roses, and everyone took a turn tossing one onto his father's coffin. Nigel tossed his rose. After him, his mom picked up a handful of damp dirt and sprinkled it on the casket. She made a dramatic show of looking for somewhere to brush off her hands. They went back to the manor, a whole procession of cars, many of them operated by hired drivers. The house filled up. There were more people there than there had been at the actual funeral. Waiters escorted around trays of hors d'oeuvres. People Nigel could barely tell apart stuffed their faces while having grave conversations. Nigel stood to the side with Bea and Jessa. They let the room come to them, as was appropriate and expected. Handshake after handshake, sometimes paired with a squeeze of his upper arm. Dozens of dainty air kisses to his cheek.
"Condolences, lad. Truly sorry about your father."
"He'll be missed."
And on and on. Nigel's neck was sore from all the nodding, his mouth dry from saying thank you over and over again. It was a bombardment of sympathy.
As the afternoon went on, his collar and tie got looser and sloppier. At some point,